Welcome in the WAGME. There are 11 chapters, I believe. Let's see. Got the book right here in front of me. There are 11 chapters. So let me throw out a few tweets. We'll get Christine in here and we will begin. I don't know why everybody doesn't just pile in here in the beginning. We've been doing pretty good by the end of the space where, gosh, there's been times when we've had more than 100 in here, and other times by the time we're through, we have a little over 50 in here. So I never understand why it isn't a little more packed in the beginning, but that is okay. Perhaps 8:30 is a little early. Maybe you should switch it to 9. Of course, that's central time where I'm at. But that's okay. Tonight, we will start Chapter 6, Rain or Shine, or where I'm at, Snow and Ice, because it's really cold where I am. And my kid's school has been out this entire week. And it's just a little more difficult. I'm not on my usual routine and schedule. But the book's been amazing so far. We've went through 5 chapters, and the most recent one called The Dynamics of Perception, which was really interesting, although I felt like it was a little long-winded at times. But Chapter 6 is going to be The Market's Perspective. You had snow for the first time this year in Virginia. Okay. Oh, for the first time this year. That makes sense. in Texas, we can go whole years without snow or ice. And it's usually ice. A lot of times whenever they say it snows in Texas, it's not really snow. It's actually ice. And that's what it is this time. There's no snowballs in the front yard. There's no snowball fights. There's no snowmen in the front yard or anything like that. It's hard ice, and it's no fun to drive on. And I know everybody says, oh, us Southerners can't drive in ice. But I'm telling you, it's not just regular snow. But anyway, I digress. Chapter 5 we've went through, and then this time it'll be called Chapter 6, The Market's Perspective, which the market's perspective should be interesting because last time we went into the typical trader's perception of the market, but now we're going to look at how the market as a whole might look at this entire thing. Now, for Chapter 6, we'll get through with it, and today we'll decide whether we go on to Chapter 7 tonight. Here's the thing. Chapter 6 is relatively short. Like, I could get through with Chapter 6 fairly easily. The problem is the following chapter, Chapter 7, is fairly lengthy. So I've got a short chapter and then Chapter 7 off of that, and we'll decide how we're going to move forward after I get through with Chapter 6. But before I do, a little bit of housekeeping. This is a live reading, and with a live reading, you're going to get me stumbling over some words. You're going to get me reading the same line twice. You're going to get me mispronouncing something important, and that's because it's a live reading. I've done audiobooks before. I'll do my best to make it an audiobook sound, but whenever it is a live read like this, I don't get the chance to edit like I get a chance to do on audiobooks. So if I ever fumble over my words on audiobooks, I get able to edit that out. You'll hear me clear my throat, that sort of thing. So just be aware, this is a live reading. After I get through with the reading, any of you are free to come up here on stage. And matter of fact, I encourage you to come up here on stage and let's discuss what we read tonight. A lot of times it's Christine and I kind of leading the conversation. We will do that. But I ask that you come on up here and discuss. Say like, oh, that really spoke to me whenever the author said this. Or I disagree with what the author said whenever they said that. So keep that in mind. One last thing before I start on Chapter 6, The Market's Perspective, is I put into ChatGPT that I said, I'm in the Golden Hour Book Club, ChatGPT, and I'd like you to write a poem for us. So get ready with your snapping fingers here. Before we start on the Trading in the Zone book, I want to read to you a little AI-generated poem. And it amused me enough that I wanted to do a live reading of it tonight. So here we go. This is what bots think of our wonderful, wonderful little book club here. Golden Hour Book Club, a group so bright, reading Trading in the Zone with all their might. A journey through the world of stock and trade. With every chapter, their knowledge is upgraded. The Golden Hour, a time of peace. With a book in hand, their minds release. The stresses of life, the worries they bear, all fade away when they gather there. Together they delve into the art of trade. With the book as their guide, they'll never stray. From the wisdom of the author, they'll find their way and master the mind in the world of finance and play. So here's to the Golden Hour Book Club, a gathering of minds ready to dub. Their knowledge and skills with every page turned in the world of finance, their success has been earned. Man, I don't know. That's pretty good. It's not bad. That's better than I could do if I were to put together a little poem about our nice little book club here. It even worked in quite a bit of trading. And of course, I told it what book we were reading, Trading in the Zone. And that's really all I did. The prompt was, write me a poem about our book club called the Golden Hour Book Club. We are reading Trading in the Zone. And that's what it output for me. So not bad at all. Christine has texted me and said that she is coming. I'm sure she has a tattoo that she is finishing up on, as she usually does on these book club nights. So she will be in here in a bit. And usually with her and her massive following, she'll bring in some people in here with us. But that is okay. Let's see. Next time, put in the chapter header as well. Oh, chapter. Okay. Yeah, we can do that in the WAGME. That's not a bad idea at all to do that. But all right, I'm going to get started with chapter six. And by the time I get through with chapter six, which is rather short, Christine will be in here and we'll probably do a little halftime and we'll decide whether we're going to go into chapter seven, or maybe we'll do a first where we go halfway into chapter seven and start out the chapter seven next week. So let's do this. Chapter six, the market's perspective. The market's perspective. Okay. For the most part, a typical trader's perception of the risk in any given trading situation is a function of the outcome of his most recent two or three trades, depending on the individual. The best traders, on the other hand, are not impacted, either negatively or too positively, by the outcomes of their last or even their last several trades. So their perception of the risk of any given trading situation is not affected by this personal psychological barrier or variable. There's a huge psychological gap here that might lead you to believe that the best traders have inherent design qualities in their minds that account for this gap. But I can assure you, this is not the case. Every trader I've worked with over the last 18 years has had to learn how to train his mind to stay properly focused in the now moment opportunity flow. This is a universal problem and has to do with both the way our minds are wired and our common social upbringing, meaning this particular, meaning this particular trading problem is not person specific. There are other factors relating to self-esteem that may also act as obstacles for your consistent success. But what we are going to discuss now is the most important and fundamental building block to your success as a trader. The uncertainty principle. If there is such a thing as a secret to the nature of trading, this is it. At the very core of one's ability to trade without fear or overconfidence, 2, perceive what the market is offering from its perspective, 3, stay completely focused in the now moment opportunity flow, and 4, spontaneously enter the zone. It is strongly and virtually unshakable belief in an uncertain outcome with an edge in your favor. The best traders have evolved to the point where they believe without a shred of doubt or internal conflict that anything can happen. They don't just suspect that anything could happen or give lip service to the idea, their belief in uncertainty is so powerful that it actually prevents their mind from associating the now moment situation and circumstance with the outcomes of their most recent trades. By preventing this association, they are able to keep their minds free of unrealistic and rigid expectations about how the market will express itself, instead of generating the kind of unrealistic expectations that more often than not result in both emotional and financial pain. They have learned to make themselves available to take advantage of whatever opportunities the market may offer in any given moment. Making yourself available is the perspective from which you understand that the framework from which you are perceiving information is limited relative to what's being offered. Bring Christine up here. Our minds don't automatically perceive every opportunity that presents itself in any given moment. The boy and the dog illustration from chapter 5 is a perfect example of how our own personal versions of the truth are reflected back to us. The same kind of perceptual blindness happens all the time in trading. We can't perceive the potential for the market to continue to move in a direction that is already against our position if, for example, we're operating out of fear of being wrong. The fear of admitting that we are wrong causes us to place an inordinate amount of significance on information that tells us that we're right. This happens if there is an ample information to indicate that the market has, in fact, established a trend in the opposite direction of our position. A trending market is a distinction about the market's behavior we can ordinarily perceive, but this distinction can easily become invisible if we're operating out of fear. The trend and the opportunity to trade in the direction of that trend don't become visible until we are out of the trade. In addition, there are opportunities that are invisible to us because we haven't learned to make the distinctions that would allow us to perceive them. Recall in our discussion in Chapter 5 that the first price chart you ever looked at, what we haven't learned yet, is invisible to us and remains invisible until our minds are open to an exchange of energy. A perspective from which you make yourself available takes into consideration both the known and the unknown. For example, you've built a mental framework that allows you to recognize a set of variables in the market's behavior that indicates when an opportunity to buy or sell is present. This is your edge and something you know. However, what you don't know is exactly how the pattern your variables identify will unfold. With the perspective of making yourself available, you know that your edge places the odds of success in your favor, but at the same time, you completely accept the fact that you don't know the outcome of any particular trade. By making yourself available, you consciously open yourself up to find out what will happen next. Instead of giving way to an automatic mental process that causes you to think you already know, adopting this perspective leaves your mind free of internal resistance that can prevent you from perceiving whatever opportunity the market is making available from its perspective, which is its truth. Your mind is open for an exchange of energy. Not only can you learn something about the market that you previously didn't know, but you also set up the mental condition most conducive to entering the zone. The essence of what it means to be in the zone is that your mind and the market are in sync. As a result, you sense what the market is about to do as if there was no separation between yourself and the collective consciousness of everyone else participating in the market. The zone is a mental space where you're doing more than just reading the collective mind. You are also in complete harmony with it. If this sounds a bit strange to you, ask yourself how it is that a flock of birds or a school of fish can change direction simultaneously. There must be a way in which they're linked to one another. If it is possible for people to become linked in the same way, then there will be times when the information from those with whom we are linked to can and will bleed through to our consciousness. Traders who have experienced being tapped into the collective consciousness of the market can anticipate a change in direction just as a bird in the middle of a flock or a fish in the middle of a school will turn at the precise moment that all of the others turn. However, setting up this kind of mental conditions most conducive to experiencing this seemingly magical synchronicity between you and the market is no easy task. There are two mental hurdles to overcome. The first is the focus of this chapter, learning how to keep your mind focused on the now moment opportunity flow. In order to experience synchronicity, your mind has to be open to the market's truth from its perspective. The second hurdle has to do with the division of labor between the two halves of our brain. The left side of our brain specializes in rational thought based on what we already know. The right side specializes in creative thought. It is capable of tapping into an inspiration, an intuition, a hunch, or a sense of knowing that usually can't be explained at a rational level. It can't be explained if the information is really creative in nature, then it is something that we wouldn't know at a rational level. By definition, true creativity brings forth something that didn't previously exist. There's an inherent conflict between these two modes of thought, that the rational, logical part will almost always win, unless we take specific steps to train our minds to accept and trust creative information. Without that training, we will usually find it very difficult to act on our hunches, intuitive impulses, inspirations, or sense of knowing. Acting appropriately on anything requires belief and clarity of intent, which keeps our minds and senses focused on the purpose at hand. If the source of our actions is creative in nature, and our rational mind hasn't been properly trained to trust this source, then at some point in the process of acting on this information, our rational brain will flood our consciousness with conflicting and competing thoughts. Of course, all of these thoughts will be sound and reasonable in nature, because they will be coming from what we already know at a rational level, but they will have the effect of flipping us out of the zone or any other creative state of mind. There are few things in life more frustrating than recognizing the possibilities evident from a hunch, intuition, or an inspired idea, and not taking advantage of that potential because we've talked ourselves out of it. I realize that what I've just said is still much too abstract to implement on a practical basis. So I'm going to take you step by step through what it means to be completely focused in the now moment opportunity flow. My objective is that by the time you've read this chapter and chapter 7, you will understand without a shred of doubt why your ultimate success as a trader cannot be realized until you develop a resolute, unshakable belief in uncertainty. The first step on the road toward getting your mind and the market in sync is to understand and completely accept the psychological realities of trading. This step is where most of the frustrations, disappointments, and mysteriousness associated with trading begin. Very few people who decide to trade ever take the time or expend the effort to think about what it means to be a trader. Most people who go into the market trading thinking that being a trader is synonymous with being a good market analyst. As I've mentioned, this couldn't be further from the truth. Good market analysis can certainly contribute to and play a supporting role in one's success, but it doesn't deserve the attention and importance most traders mistakenly attach to it. Beneath the market behavior patterns that are so easy to read and so easy to become fixated on, in some very unique psychological characteristics. It's the nature of these psychological characteristics that determine how one needs to be in order to operate effectively in the market environment. Operating effectively in a market environment that has qualities, traits, or characteristics that are different from what we're used to requires making some adjustments or changes in the way we normally think about things. For example, if you were to travel to an exotic place with certain objectives or goals to accomplish, the first thing you would do is familiarize yourself with the local traditions and customs. By doing so, you would learn about the various ways in which you would have to adapt in order to function successfully in that environment. Traders frequently ignore the fact that they may have to adapt in order to become consistently successful traders. There are two reasons for this. The first is that you need absolutely no skill of any kind to put on a winning trade. For most traders, it usually takes years of pain and suffering before they figure out and finally admit to themselves that there's more to being consistent than the ability to pick an occasional winner. The second reason is that you don't have to travel anywhere to trade. All you need access to is a phone. You don't even have to roll out of bed in the morning. Even traders who normally trade from an office don't have to be in the office to put in or take off their trades, because we can access and interact with the market from personal environments that we're intimately familiar with. It seems as if trading won't require any special adaptations in the way we think. To some degree, you are probably already aware many of the fundamental truths or psychological characteristics about the nature of trading. But having an awareness or an understanding of some principle, insight, or concept doesn't necessarily equate to acceptance and belief. When something has been truly accepted, it isn't in conflict with any other component of our mental environment. When we believe in something, we operate out of that belief as a natural function of who we are, without struggle or extra effort. To whatever degree there is a conflict with any other component of our mental environment, to the same degree, there's a lack of acceptance. It isn't difficult, therefore, to understand why so few people make it as traders. They simply don't do the mental work necessary to reconcile the many conflicts that exist between what they've already learned and believe and how that learning contradicts and acts as a source of resistance to implementing the various principles of successful trading. Getting into and taking advantage of the kind of free-flowing states of mind that are ideal for trading requires that those conflicts be thoroughly resolved. The market's most fundamental characteristic: it can express itself in an almost infinite combination of ways. The market can do virtually anything at any time. This seems obvious enough, especially for anybody who has experienced a market that has displayed erratic and volatile price swings. The problem is that all of us have the tendency to take this characteristic for granted in ways that cause us to make the most fundamental trading errors over and over again. The fact is that if traders really believed that anything could happen at any time, there would be considerably fewer losers and more consistent winners. How do we know that virtually anything can happen? This fact is easy to establish. All we have to do is dissect the market into its component parts and look at how the parts operate. The most fundamental component of any market is its traders. Individual traders act as a force on prices, making them move up, move by either bidding a price up or offering it lower. Why do traders bid a price up or offer it lower? To answer this question, we have to establish the reasons why people trade. There are many reasons and purposes behind a person's motivation to trade in any given market. However, for the purposes of this illustration, we don't have to know all of the underlying reasons that compel any individual trader to act, because ultimately, they all boil down to one reason and one purpose: to make money. We know this because there are only two things that a trader can do: buy and sell. And there are only two possible outcomes for every trade: profit or loss. Therefore, I think we can safely assume that regardless of one's reasons for trading, the bottom line is that everyone is looking for the same outcome: profits. And there are only two ways to create those profits: either buy low and sell high, or sell high and buy low. If we assume that everyone wants to make money, then there's only one reason why any trader would bid a price up to the next highest level: because he believes he can sell whatever he's buying at a higher price at some point in the future. The same is true for the trader who's willing to sell something at a price that is less than the last posted price offer a market lower. He does it because he believes he can buy back whatever he's selling at a lower price at some point in the future. If we look at the market's behavior as a function of price movement, and if price movement is a function of traders who are willing to bid prices up or offer them lower, then we can say that all price movement or market behavior is a function of what traders believe about the future. To be more specific, all price movement is a function of what individual traders believe about what is high and what is low. The underlying dynamics of market behavior are quite simple. Only three primary forces exist in any market: traders who believe the price is low, traders who believe the price is high, and traders who are watching and waiting to make up their minds about whether the price is low or high. Technically, the third group constitutes a potential force. The reasons that support any given trader's belief that something is high or low are usually irrelevant, because most people who trade act in an undisciplined, unorganized, haphazard, and random manner. So the reasons wouldn't necessarily help anyone gain a better understanding of what is going on. But understanding what's going on isn't that difficult if you remember that all price movement, or lack of movement, is a function of the relative balance or imbalance between two primary forces: traders who believe the price is going up and traders who believe the price is going down. If there's balance between the two groups, prices will stagnate, because each side will absorb the force of the other side's actions. If there is an imbalance, prices will move in the direction of the greater force, or the traders who have the stronger convictions in their beliefs about in what direction the price is going. Now, I want you to ask yourself, what's going to stop virtually anything from happening at any time, other than exchange-imposed limits on price movement? There's nothing to stop the price of an issue from going as high or low, or whatever some trader in the world believes is possible, if, of course, the trader is willing to act on that belief. So the range of the market's behavior in its collective form is limited only by the most extreme beliefs about what is high and what is low held by any given individual participating in that market. I think the implications are self-evident. There can be an extreme diversity of beliefs present in any given market in any given moment, making virtually anything possible. When we look at the market from this perspective, it's easy to see that every potential trader who's willing to express his belief about the future becomes a market variable. On a more personal level, this means that it only takes one other trader anywhere in the world to negate the positive potential of your trade. Put in another way, it only takes one other trader to negate what you believe about what is high or what is low. That's all. Only one. Here's an example to illustrate this point. Several years ago, a trader came to me for help. He was an excellent market analyst. In fact, he was one of the best I've ever seen. But after years of frustration, during which he lost all his money and a lot of other people's money, he was finally ready to admit that, as a trader, he left a lot to be desired. After talking to him for a while, I determined that a number of serious psychological obstacles were preventing him from being successful. One of the most troublesome obstacles was that he was a know-it-all and extremely arrogant, making it impossible for him to achieve the degree of mental flexibility required to trade effectively. It didn't matter how good an analyst he was. When he came to me, he was so desperate for money and help that he was willing to consider anything. The first suggestion I made was that instead of looking for another investor to back what ultimately would be another failed attempt at trading, he would be better off taking a job, doing something he was truly good at. He could be paid a steady income while working through his problems, and at the same time provide something of a worthwhile service. He took my advice and quickly found a position as a technical analyst with a fairly substantial brokerage house and clearing firm in Chicago. The semi-retired chairman of the board of the brokerage firm was a longtime trader with nearly 40 years of experience in the grain pits of the Chicago Board of Trade. He didn't know much about technical analysis because he never needed it to make money on the floor. But he no longer traded on the floor and found the transition to a trading from a screen difficult and somewhat mysterious. So he asked the firm's newly acquired star technical analyst to sit with him during the trading day and teach him technical trading. The new hire jumped at the opportunity to show off his abilities to such an experienced and successful trader. The analyst was using a technical method called point and line that, when interpreted correctly, can accurately define support and resistance. One day, as the two of them were watching the soybean market together, the analyst had projected major support and resistance points, and the market happened to be trading between these two points. As the technical trader was explaining to the chairman the significance between those two points, he stated, in very emphatic, almost absolute terms, that if the market goes up to resistance, it will stop in reverse. And if the market goes down to support, it will also stop in reverse. Then he explained that if the market went down to the price level he calculated as support, his calculations indicated that would also be the low of the day. As they sat there, the bean market was slowly trending down to the price the analyst said would be support, or low of the day. When it finally got there, the chairman looked over to the analyst and said, "This is where the market's supposed to stop and go higher, right?" The analyst responded, "Absolutely. This is the low of the day." "That's bullshit," the chairman retorted. "Watch this." He picked up the phone, called one of the clerks handling the orders for the soybean pit, and said, "Sell 2 million beans, bushels, at the market." Within 30 seconds after he placed the order, the soybean market dropped 10 cents a bushel. The chairman turned back and looked at the horrified expression on the analyst's face. Calmly, he asked, "Now, where did you say the market was going to stop?" "If I can do that, anyone can." Oh, no. There we go. The point is that from our own individual perspective as observers of the market, anything can happen, and it takes only one trader to do it. This is the hard, cold reality of trading that is only the very best traders have embraced and accepted with no internal conflict. How do I know this? Because only the best traders consistently predefine their risks before entering a trade. Only the best traders cut their losses without reservation or hesitation when the market sells, when the market tells them the trade isn't working. And only the best traders have an organized, systematic money management regimen for taking profits when the market goes in the direction of their trade. Not predefining your risk, not cutting your losses, or not systematically taking profits are three of the most common and usually the most costly trading errors you can make. Only the best traders have eliminated these errors from their trading. At some point in their careers, they learn to believe without a shred of doubt that anything can happen, and to always account for what they don't know, for the unexpected. Remember, there are only two forces that cause the prices to move: traders who believe the markets are going up and traders who believe the markets are going down. At any given moment, we can see who has the stronger conviction by observing where the market is now relative to where it was at some previous moment. If a recognizable pattern is present, that pattern may repeat itself, giving us an indication of where the market is headed. This is our edge, something we know. But there's also much that we don't know, and we'll never know unless we learn how to read minds. For instance, do we know how many traders may be sitting on the sidelines about to enter the market? Do we know how many of them want to buy and how many want to sell, or how many shares they're willing to buy and sell? What about the traders whose participation is already reflected in the current price? At any given moment, how many of them are about to change their minds and exit their positions? If they do, how long will they stay out of the market? And if and when they do come back into the market, in what direction will they cast their votes? These are the constant, never-ending, unknown, hidden variables that are always operating in every market, always. The best traders don't trade to hide from these unknown variables by pretending they don't exist, nor do they try to intellectualize or rationalize them away from market analysis. Quite the contrary, the best traders take these variables into account, factoring them into every component of their trading regimes. For the typical trader, just the opposite is true. He trades from the perspective that what he can't see, hear, or feel must not exist. What other explanation could account for his behavior? If he really believed in the existence of all of the hidden variables that have the potential to act on prices at any given moment, then he would also have to believe that every trade has an uncertain outcome. And if every trade truly has an uncertain outcome, then how could he ever justify or talk himself not predefining his risk, cutting his losses, or having some systematic way to take profits? Given the circumstances, not adhering to these three fundamental principles is the equivalent of committing financial and emotional suicide. Since most traders don't adhere to these principles, are we to assume that their true underlying motivation for trading is to destroy themselves? It's certainly possible, but I think the percentage of traders who either consciously or subconsciously want to rid themselves of their money or hurt themselves in some way is extremely small. So, if financial suicide is not the predominant reason, then what would keep someone from doing something that would otherwise make absolute perfect sense? The answer is quite simple. The typical trader doesn't predefine his risk, cut his losses, or systematically take profits because the typical trader doesn't believe it's necessary. The only reason why he would believe it isn't necessary is that he believes he already knows what's going to happen next based on what he perceives is happening in any given now moment. If he already knows, then there's really no reason to adhere to these principles. Believing, assuming, or thinking that he knows will be the cause to virtually every trading error he has the potential to make, with the exception of those errors there is the result of not believing that he deserves the money. Our beliefs about what is true and real are very powerful inner forces. They control every aspect of how we interact with the markets, from our perceptions, interpretations, decisions, actions, and expectations to our feelings about the results. It's extremely difficult to act in a way that contradicts what we believe to be true. In some cases, depending on the strength of the belief, it can be next to impossible to do anything that violates the integrity of a belief. What the typical trader doesn't realize is that he needs an inner mechanism in the form of some powerful beliefs that virtually compels him to perceive the market from a perspective that is always expanding with greater and greater degree of clarity, and also compels him to always act appropriately, given the psychological conditions and the nature of the price movement. The most effective and functional trading belief that he can acquire is that anything can happen. Aside from the fact that it is the truth, it will act as a solid foundation for building every other belief and attitude that he needs to be a successful trader. Without that belief, his mind will automatically, and usually without conscious awareness, cause him to avoid, block, or rationalize away any information that indicates the market may do something that he hasn't accepted as possible. If he believes that anything is possible, then there's nothing for his mind to avoid, because anything includes everything. This belief will act as an expansive force on his perception of the market that will allow him to perceive information that might otherwise have been invisible to him. In essence, he will be making himself available or opening his mind to perceive more of the possibilities that exist from the market's perspective. Most important, by establishing a belief that anything can happen, he will be training his mind to think in probabilities. This, by far, is the most essential as well as the most difficult principle for most people to grasp and to effectively integrate into their mental systems. And that is chapter 6. We did it, everybody. Thank you. How'd you do that? It looked like you were on mute, but you were playing that that clapping sound. How'd you do that?
It's so weird because I muted myself now and it won't let me. So who knows?
Okay. That is weird. Yeah. And I brought you up to co-host and then I started reading. And then I just happened to glance at the phone and I realized that you weren't as a co-host anymore. So what happened?
I don't know. I was listening and reading along with the PDF that I posted up there. And then I didn't even notice. And then I clicked back and I was not in the room at all. So I came back in.
That's weird. But yeah, glad you are here. About what point did you jump in on? I know you had to, I'm sure, finish up a tattoo. About what point were you able to jump in?
I believe it was pretty, I think it was like 7 minutes in.
Okay. So not that long. I did wait a little bit for you, but after a while I was like, well, who knows how long it could take her. So I went ahead and got started. But this was an interesting chapter. And one that I feel like I needed to hear a little bit. It's rather short. But one of the things it said, what did you think about that story about the know-it-all trader that was with the other, used to be on the floor type of trader? That guy kind of screwed him over, right? That where he just said, hey, watch this. And then just basically completely screwed over his support and resistance line. What'd you think of that?
Yeah, I think it was crazy because, you know, he started feeling like, you know, he was obviously confident and he was known as a successful trader, but on the floor. And then so it's something completely different to trade off the screen. And then you get this kid, or I want to say kid, you know, some guy that's teaching him technical analysis. And then he is confident in what he knows. And then this guy just makes a phone call and he's like, oh, sell 2 million of these beans. And then it just totally. So it just shows on both ends, like everything you know isn't absolute. You
but
know?
It shows that just one trader could do that, right? Just one trader. And imagine if there were two traders or five traders that just happened to do the same type of thing, and it can move the market against the way you think it'll be. And I'll tell you personally, you can tell me whether this is you or not, where I run into what this chapter talks about is I will be convinced the market is going a certain direction. I'll have every technical indicator. I'll have every fundamental indication that it's going either up or down. And next thing you know, it won't. Right. And it will go. I've told you before, I don't always have stop losses within the software I'm using. Sometimes I just have a mental stop loss. And that can be dangerous if I don't have my mind right, because it will go the other direction and I'll convince myself, well, it clearly is just kind of doing a little breathing and kind of going up to there. It's going to go back down because everything says it's going to go back down or back up, whatever. And then so I'll either move the stop loss or just say, well, let's make it just a little bit higher and see where it goes there. And next thing you know, it does go a little bit higher or maybe a lot higher. And then at that point, I'm like, I'm so in on this thing. I might as well just ride it to the ground now because, you know, I'm over my head in the trade. And yeah. I just know
it. You're like negative 30%. You're like, well, I'll just stay now. But and that's happened to me so many times. Like, I felt like you were describing every time that happened to me. And it's so crazy because the psychology of a trader, it's, we all go through this and we know it and we know what we should and shouldn't do. And we still get caught up in it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what this chapter really gets into, where it's saying that, you know, the market could go up or down. And if I will accept that, then I'll probably just listen to my stop loss. I will say that if I could get stats on every time that I moved my stop loss, because sometimes it does work out, right? Sometimes it ends up, I was right. But I would like to have stats on whenever I have moved my stop loss, did it end up working out for me? And if I just anecdotally think about it, if I don't have the actual stats and I think about it, then I'll bet you it would show that more often than not, it's the wrong move, right? I bet you I lose more money by doing that than by adhering to it. But it's hard to adhere to it. And that's, I'll say this to anybody that's listening, that is the danger of having mental stops, is you've really got to have them there. You know, it's really tempting. You're really leaving it up to temptation to not be able to.
Right. And your emotions better not be there. Like if you're doing that mental stop loss, you know, and I constantly go against just setting the stop loss and walking away, which I should do. Like, I know I should do that, but I'm like, no, I'm going to watch it and I'm going to determine when I'm getting out and I'm emotionless right now. And then lo and behold, I'll be like, no, I'm going to move it a little bit. I'm going to move it again. Like, it's going my way. And then sure enough, I keep pushing it to the edge and then I just commit financial suicide.
Well, especially with options, it can be so volatile. But okay, so I've told you that since we've done this, we've been doing this trading in the zone, I've kind of got back into crypto trading and a little bit of Forex trading. Here's something that I have dealt with, and you can tell me whether you deal with this in options. If you've got your mental game down and you just do what we've learned so far, just to accept the losses, right? Just to say, hey, hit the stop. This was a possibility, and I'm just going to accept the losses. I think here's the mental battle I'm fighting, and you can tell me if you're fighting it too, is if I accept the losses and I still take, you know, the profits, right? And overall, I'm winning, right? Overall, I'm winning more than I'm losing. Not saying I'm green every day, but on, you know, maybe I'm green by the end of a week, something like that. But if I take those losses consistently, then I don't have these outsized gains. You know, maybe one day if it's options, I'm making, you know, 100%, you know, 500%, and I'm also losing, you know, quite a bit at the same time. And it makes it to where my equity curve doesn't go up in the big stair step fashion that we would all like it to go. So my question is, if you do all of the things in this book, does it make trading, do I want to have money or do I want to have a dopamine rush? Because that's what I'm kind of getting into. I'm like, if I do this, it's going to make the equity curve go up, but slowly and not as exciting. And
about Voice of DeFi, remember on Monday, we were like, we have to make this where it's not like a dopamine rush. It has to be where it's very emotionless and boring. Like, okay, I made gains today. Nice. Coming back tomorrow. Very like monotone, because if there is dopamine and there is a rush, then the emotions are involved.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we have to all just kind of get our, you hear that Texan? Anytime I say the word get, it really comes out. It's like, yet. Anyway, yeah, it really kind of brings it out of us whenever we're dealing with these market emotions. There's one sentence that I wanted to read that was part of this because it really just states it matter-of-factly. It says, three of the most common and usually most costly trading errors you can make. Okay, so I felt like whenever he says that, it's like, okay, get out your pen and paper because he's going to tell us the three most costly trading errors you can make. So here they are. Not predefining your risk. That would be stop loss, right? Not cutting your losses. That would be stop loss. Or not systematically taking profits are three of the most common and usually the most costly trading errors you can make. So I think what basically he's saying here is we do need to be a little more rigid in that this is how much my risk is. This is where the stop loss is, bar none. We don't move it up. We don't tease it up because we believe the market's going a certain direction. Just bar none, that's what it is. And then lastly, we've got to be able to take profits, which I know that's something you personally have worked on quite a bit over the last year.
Yeah, but I'll still find myself slipping up because of that dopamine rush where you're like, oh my gosh, and I'm over here sizing up. And I keep telling myself, and we talked about this last time on Monday, like we need to relax on sizing up, you know, just relax. You know, just get super bored and very routine, like with it, be a robot, you know, in trading and be consistent and stop trying to change things up and give into that dopamine rush. It's so bad for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. I'm going to ask you to kind of be personally introspective here. If you're looking at what you're doing worse between these two things, is it taking profits for you or is it moving stop losses? Which one bites you in the butt more often?
Moving stop loss.
Yeah, I agree. I'll say this. I wish it was in profits because that would mean like a lot of my trades are, you know, in the green and therefore I'm just not taking profits, right? But I think the problem is, and this is where it gets into why we see if you don't have your mental game right, it can mess with your equity curve, is the problem is we take our profits because I'm like, I've been burned so many times. I'm up 5%. I just need to get out of this trade because it could go down to minus 30%, right? So I start cutting off my profits at 5%, right? Because I'm just getting so convinced that, that you know, something's going to go bad. But then whenever it gets to minus 10%, minus 15%, I let that ride a little bit. So I'm doing the opposite of what you should do. I'm not letting my winners run. I'm letting my losers run and I'm cutting off the winners because I just want to be right, right? I just want to be able to cut off that trade in the green and I'm just so scared of being wrong. So again, do I want to be right in the dopamine, you know, have that dopamine rush, or do I want to be boringly right on the whole and not anything like that? By the way, did you trade FOMC today?
No, I didn't because it was so bad for me last time when I traded FOMC. And Dre, I see Dre in here and he traded FOMC last time and he blew up his account. And I've done that. I blew half of my account up because it's so volatile. And so I told myself like, okay, I'm not going to trade FOMC, but I was jealous. I was watching the whole time and SPY was crazy. Everything was crazy. And I see Knots in here, and I think about a week ago, he was having like a couple bad days, and he was like, somebody run me over. Like, who drives? Like, Jordan, you drive a boat. Do you know how to drive it? Like, can you run me over? Like, I'm just having like the worst time. But then he had like a huge day, like on the, I think like the third or fourth day, it was like one of his biggest weeks. And it made me think of when you were saying, you know, it's individualized trades, and just because we have like a red day or two red days, three red days doesn't define us as a trader. Like if we're sticking to our plan, but it's crazy. It's crazy. So I didn't trade today, but I was jealous. I wanted to. I was trying to not give into my dopamine rush. I know I would have been giving into it because it's so volatile.
Sure. Well, let me say this, since you did bring up Knots, is before every FOMC, Knots, you put out a thread that says this is how you trade FOMC. And I've seen you put that out for some time. And this time I decided to go with what you said. And while I didn't let it ride as long as I could have, it 100%. Now, I didn't do it with options, to be clear. I just did it. It's hard to explain how I did it, but I did it with crypto. Where you anyway? Forget it. I'm not going to get into what I did.
He
But
does crypto too.
okay, well, but it was crypto through it was SPY through crypto. It anyway. It's hard to
What the
explain.
heck?
Don't worry about it. I'll explain offline. But point is, it works the exact same. Worked the exact same as trading SPY, and I did exactly what his thread says to do, and it worked well. It worked well. It didn't run for as long as I could have let it run, and that gets into a little bit of the whole I'm green, let's cut this thing off while I'm green right now. And if I would have let it run, I could have done really,
A
really well.
thousand percent. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I would have done really, really well, but that's okay. That's okay. Again, I'm not going to beat myself up
And
over.
we can't do the dopamine rush, right? The only thing we could do is leave a runner. And depending on what, you know, your definition of runner is, whether that's one contract or a few, whatever, that's the only thing that we could let run, because it doesn't matter if those go to zero because we're already in profit, and that's just whatever.
Yeah, but okay, so earlier, I think it was chapter two, it mentioned that whenever we leave a lot of money on the table, whenever we close out our trade too soon, that that's one of the hardest mentally, and I agreed with this whenever he said it, is it's hard mentally because you have no one to blame but yourself, right? If otherwise something happens and you get stopped out or something, you're like, damn market, you know, is doing all this stupid stuff, and it's just a dumb market, you know, all that. But whenever you get out of the trade on your own choice, you know, you're the one who got out of the trade too soon. We have no one to blame but ourselves, and I think that's harder to deal with mentally because now I can't play the blame game except unless I just look in the mirror.
Right. But I always try to, so there's he's usually in here, but he had told me Tesla last week. He was so happy because he got out at over 100%, and he was like, oh my gosh. And I actually, like, you know, cashed out. I did so awesome. Well, he looked back and he was upset because he was like, it would have did 5,000%. And I was like, why'd you look back? And he's like, I'm so mad. I should have just left some runners. And I'm like, okay, but don't look back. Like, you made your money. Like, it doesn't matter, right? And he's like, yes, it does matter. I should have just stayed a little bit. And then there you go again. Like, we're just fighting ourselves. And we have to stick to our plan. It has to be boring. It can't be a roller coaster, guys. Like, we have to be consistent. It's like going to the gym. Like, we're not erratically doing a bunch of different things every day. It becomes like a routine. Like, once you're there, like, you know, a week or two, you start doing the same thing over and over and over. Like, I think it has to be like that for us to consistently make money.
Yeah, but this gets into a little bit of what we were talking about last week, where we were talking about, you know, when do you up your position size, right? Like, let's say you're consistently profitable, right? And you start out with, I don't know, $5,000, and you get it up to $10,000, and when do you start, you know, doubling your position size? And what we're talking about now, I think what many would say to do is to, yeah, sure, double it, but you know, half of that you've doubled, go ahead and close out where you might have before, and then let the other half that you have now run. So it may be maybe the solution to the problem that we had proposed last week of how do you increase your position size once you are profitable, because that can be just as dangerous as well, is the overconfidence that you get from being profitable. And that may be like you talked about Dre getting bit by FOMC last time. that may be what was at play there is, you know, I don't know what his trades were the days leading up to that, but maybe he was starting to feel pretty confident from some good trades, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and he was. And then I remember telling him not to trade FOMC, and he said he wasn't, and then he did. And he's like, I messed up.
Messed up bad, yo. FOMC can be, I'll say this after dealing with FOMC today, you got to be right by, this isn't a set it and forget it thing. You got to be right by the chart and be really close to just, you know, I was prepared to lose money today whenever I was doing it. But like I said, I kind of had a plan to go with it, and it worked well, and I'll probably try to do that again next time. It wasn't my usual strategy, but I felt like I still had a plan. And, you know, I understand a lot of people may have a different plan whenever a huge announcement like that is made. What's up, Dre? How are you?
I am good. Voice of DeFi. What up?
What is up?
Oh, my God. I'm home. Hi, peoples. How are you guys? Yeah, I blew my account up, and I haven't traded since, and I've been sad. Anyways.
You will trade another day. I believe that, but sometimes you have to let your wounds heal. I know you got the Band-Aids and the bandages on.
I had to get stitches after that one. Oh, God damn. I was like, that one hurt my back.
Yeah. It may take you some physical therapy and a lot of pain pills and things like that. You can... You too can get that horse after that.
If you follow Christine, me on did you IG, see? Oh, my bad voice. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I want to hear.
No, I just said I want to hear your. I'm not even trading no more. I'm going to the gym. That's how bad it hurt me. I am in the gym because I am like I'm not even joking. You guys, Christine, I'd be posting that shit every day. I'm like, fuck them. I'm not trading nothing anymore.
Look, I've told you, Dre, your secret to making money in this world. I've told you, it's a cooking channel, a vegan cooking channel, where 3/4 of the way through your meal that you're preparing, you go shirtless. Okay.
Oh, I am so down. Let's do it.
I mean, okay, it's just like, okay, like you're a built dude, okay? And I think it would be like your thing about like, when's he gonna do it? When's he gonna do it? Oh, it's right here when he cuts the onions. Right here when he cuts the onions. He's like, oh, sure, it's getting hot in here. And take that bank, man. Take that to the bank.
Oh, you my can do God. It. I'm going to flip the egg, and while it's in the air, I got to rip the shirt off with one arm on the one side. Just, and then catch the egg. All right, I got this.
Yeah, it's just sometimes that you take your shirt off, so everyone, that's like the catch of the show. That's hilarious.
Yes, everybody needs like a, you know, a what am I trying to say, like a tagline or a phrase or something, but Dre's will be more of a visual thing. And yeah, you can have a tagline or phrase to it. Anyway, I digress. Christine, did you see the poem about the Golden Hour Book Club that ChatGPT put together? Oh, you are in for a treat, and everybody else in here is in for a treat. I did a reading of it before the chapter tonight. But I will do another reading just for you, because ChatGPT is a genius. Okay, so you haven't read this, am I right? You've never heard this, right?
Never heard it.
Oh, yes. Okay, here we go. You're in for a treat. This is ChatGPT's poem for the Golden Hour the Golden Hour Book Club. Here we go. Golden Hour Book Club, a group so bright, reading, trading in the zone with all their might. A journey through the world of stock and trade. With every chapter, their knowledge is upgrade. The Golden Hour, a time of peace. With a book in hand, their minds release. The stresses of life, the worries they bear, all fade away when they gather there. Together they delve into the art of trade. With the book as their guide, they'll never stray. From the wisdom of the author, they'll find their way and master the mind in the world of finance and play. So here's to the Golden Hour Book Club, a gathering of minds ready to dub their knowledge and skills with every page turned in the world of finance. Their success has been earned. Check that out, Christine. Is that not freaking amazing?
Oh my gosh, can that be like our intro?
Yes, it needs to be.
ChatGPT's so insane. And that's so good. I at first I was like, this is gonna be so funny. And I'm like, wait, actually, this is really good.
Yeah.
Dude, ChatGPT is amazing.
It absolutely is. The
I
prompt
passed the law school with it.
I've heard of people doing things like that. I the prompt I put in was, we have a book club called the Golden Hour Book Club. We're reading Trading in the Zone. Write me a poem. That was the prompt. And that's what it spit out. And yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome.
I
So
don't know if you want to make it, because if you guys don't know, Voice of DeFi is also a good rapper. So it's up to you. This should be our intro,
yes.
and we own it after
Yes.
you use
Do
that
it.
poem to like, you drop a beat, and then you're like, it becomes bars. Yeah, it becomes bars, or it's a poem. It's up to you, but that's our intro.
I might be able to pull that off. There is a I don't know if you guys remember. There's an app. I'm sure it's still on the App Store, but it used to be called like Rapify or Hip-Hopify or something like that. And you could.
I remember that one.
Okay, and I'm sure it's still out there. But if I said it, I could probably get a beat behind it, and it would kind of auto-tune me and cool stuff like that.
Oh
So
my
yeah.
gosh, yes.
Okay. You mean, because right now I've got my smart. I got this, but I like the idea of what you're talking about better. I think, I don't know, maybe I could rap to that. Who knows? Who knows?
Oh my god. Well, we could
Once
have that,
upon a
right? Like,
time in a world alone, we had the
oh
Golden
my.
Big Book Club all in the zone.
Oh, what is happening over here?
Think
Oh my
Drake.
god. No, yeah, so we could do it to where that is like the waiting room kind of music, and then as like we are done sharing, we play the intro 'cause it's short.
Yeah, I'm down. I'm down. I like it. See, ChatGPT is changing our world already.
We own it. We don't even have to ask anyone.
No one owns this. We own that, Christine. We own that poem. So, yeah, it was a good one. So that was chapter six, which was the market's perspective, because chapter five was what our own perspective was, which I had said that I thought chapter five was a little hokey and a little, I don't know, light on, I don't know, it was a little hocus pocus, I felt like. But chapter six was straight up facts. Something occurred to me with you, Christine, as I was reading chapter six there. And I wanted to ask you about this because I've said, I mean, you and I have dealt with art for quite a bit with NFTs, right? And you are an artist, like you have that ability to appreciate art in a way that I don't, because I'm quite analytical minded. I just don't see art in the way that an artist does. But it kind of compared, you know, knowing the market to having a little bit of analysis aptitude. So my question was this: do you, as an artist, since you kind of have both sides of your brain kind of functioning, do you see charts or anything in a different way than we might because you do have that artistic side, or would that be just a myth? Like you don't feel like that's the case at all?
Don't know if I like co in comparison to just a more analytical brain.
Yeah, like you've got somebody that is just straight up a human calculator, right? And they're, what is that, left-brained, I think. That's whenever you're analytical. And then
That's me.
that's you. Yeah, straight up just that. And then you've got somebody like yourself who obviously has an analytical side, but obviously you have something that I do not, and that's the right side of your brain, the creative side. And so I wasn't sure if that was the case, if you felt like somehow your ability to be creative, you know, helps you out somehow
I
in.
don't think it helps me out. I think I see it more like because artists are more, they're considered to be more emotional and this and that. So, and as the more successful you are at trading, and it's because you have detached more and more emotion from that. And me being an artist and having too much emotion, like I think I look at it emotionally and I shouldn't. And so I have more to let go than the left brain person.
I've never thought about that because, yeah, at least the rap on artists is that they are very emotional because it comes into their work and things like that. I think like Van Gogh with you know, cutting the ear off, that sort of thing. Obviously, an emotional being there, and I've never thought about that. Maybe that makes it more difficult for you as you have like some emotions that you know, cling on to and that sort of thing that maybe an analytical mind doesn't. But at the same time, an analytical mind, we probably are more susceptible to the, I think I'm right. I know I'm right because I've done this analysis and there's no way I could be wrong. I don't know. I feel like that's what I, that's how I stub my toe. I guess we've all got our own ways in which we do that.
Yeah, that was a Crazy question too, because I never thought of it like that. But also, during chapter six, I know we're wrapping up right now, but you had talked about financial suicide, and it just
Oh,
stuck
yeah.
in my head. And I'm like, how many lives do we have? Like, how many times can we commit financial suicide?
Well, Dre committed financial suicide. It sounds like, last FOMC.
Bruh, I be doing that shit all the time. I think to myself, like, goddamn, when am I
Like,
gonna
how many
stop
times have
fucking
you
off
committed
all my
financial
money?
suicide, Dre?
Huh?
How many times do you think that you've committed financial suicide?
I would say at least 50 times. Not even joking.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm saying. Like, how many times does someone have? Like, we're not
Like,
past nine
we can
times.
go FOMC. You did tell me not to trade, and I did it anyways. And then there's times when we've all come together collectively and said, Christine, sell your NFT, and you didn't. And then it went down to zero. And there's so many times we've done it. It's probably thousands of times if you really think about it.
Yeah, but I don't know that holding on to an NFT to zero is necessarily financial suicide. But
It
whenever
is. When it was like $10,000 and she bought one of those Hello Bears. What was it called again?
Shut up.
Okay Bear.
Yeah, it's an okay bear. And look, everything's gonna be okay. That's what
I
I
came in for the slogan, so
It Right.
did. She did. No, but we definitely do make those decisions. I mean, financial suicide, I put $1 million into something that was not 100% guaranteed and lost it. So, like, you know what I mean? We do that in life, and that's how we learn.
It is, but you say you've done it 50 or so times. I think that's the thing. On some financial suicides that we commit, we need a little time to heal up. And that's what I think you're taking right now, Dre, because I don't think you've done your last
A
trade tomorrow.
100%.
Yeah. And sometimes that time we need to heal, it might be 6 months, it might be 12 months, it might be longer than that. But whenever that sting, because to me, if you get back too soon and you've still got that sting from the financial suicide from the previous time, that gets into the mental game too, where it's just so fresh in your mind and you just can't think straight. And so I think it's good that you're probably taking some time away if you felt really burned by that. What's up, Dre?
No, I was just gonna say, okay, I agree with you, but not 100%. And this is just my opinion, okay? So don't get mad at me. I do think that we do need time to heal, especially initially, but I always had the theory of that you have to come back to the game while it still hurts because that's what keeps you from making that same mistake again, right? That's why they say toxic relationships is because people will come back to each other after they healed and forget the wrong that the other person did because they wanna make things work, blah, 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 and they get themselves back into the same situation because they think, oh, time healed it and it's not gonna happen. When reality is, you need to be more alert to everything around you and hurt and defensive, you know?
Absolutely. So I've got a good example for that because I read it this week, and it was Kobe Bryant and his daughter. I understand we had their 3-year anniversary of their death the other day, but I'm still going to tell a story about the two of them. And one time, his daughter got a fourth place trophy, and she brought it home. And Kobe said, "What are you going to do with that?" And she said, "I'm going to throw it away. I don't need this." And she was trying to kind of, I think, please her dad by by saying this is just worthless. It's a fourth place trophy. Who cares about a fourth place trophy? And he said, "Why don't you hang it up? Put it right there in front of you. Put it right there where it's the first thing you see whenever you wake up in the morning. First thing you see is that fourth place trophy." And he goes, "And let it drive you. Let it remind you of the hurt you had for winning fourth place and the slap in the face of giving you a trophy after that. And think about that. Let that drive you to make sure that you never get one of these fourth place trophies ever again." So I feel like that's kind of getting into what you're saying, Dre, of it's like, don't forget about it too much. Remember it enough to remember that that stuff hurts. And yeah, I think that's exactly what Kobe was trying to say. So good little story by Kobe. Next week, what is today? Today's Wednesday. Yeah. So this Monday, the February the 6th, is whenever we're going to meet again for the Golden Hour Book Club. It will be the chapter 7 called The Trader's Edge: Thinking in Probabilities. I'm excited about this one, Christine, because I am an analytical mind and I do try to think of life in probabilities, right? Okay, I'm married now, but whenever I would like see a girl, you think like, what are my probabilities of asking her out? That sort of thing. So
You measure it like that?
not like It's not where I actually have a number to it. I don't think, like, I've got a 63% chance of her accepting my advance here. I don't. It's not quite that nerdy, but I think everyone does that on some level. It's just like, like I said, it sounds wrong to say analytical, but you do kind of a cost benefit analysis of am I gonna make this approach or not? I know you.
I use a risk analysis.
Let's hear about your risk analysis, Matt. I want to know how you go about the situation.
If I'm approaching a woman, I just kind of look like, okay, what are the cons? Yeah, she looks good, she's hot, but what are the cons here right now? What does she have, a crazy ex? You know, right. Something like I always look at the risk. Like, all right, if I really get involved, you know, where am I gonna end up if this goes south? So. If the cons outweigh the pros, like from a risk analysis perspective, I won't even bother.
So if you're an attractive female and Matt's near you and he's like riding this tea table and he's riding one thing on one thing on this, he's got intentions, man.
You can tell. I mean, if you say hi and she's automatically starts talking about her ex, like run for the hills.
Yes, definitely run. Well, I don't know that Chapter 7 next week is going to get into the dating probabilities, but it does say thinking and probabilities, so who knows? But yeah, everybody make sure you tune in on Monday the 6th at 9:30 Eastern, 8:30 Central, 6:30 Pacific, and we'll start here then, and we'll start Chapter 7. It's called The Trader's Edge, Thinking and Probabilities. Now, I do have to say next week's Chapter 7 is rather lengthy. So, like, tonight's Chapter 6 was a little bit short in my mind, but we've had some good discussion here about it afterwards. But Chapter 7 is, I don't know, maybe even double the size of, of Chapter 6. So, yeah, make sure you get here right here in the beginning. I'll set up shortly after the space tonight, the Chapter 7 space, so you can go ahead and hit the reminder and be ready for it. But Christine, before we kind of wrap up, or anybody else here on stage, any other things you want to talk about what Chapter 6 had tonight, which was kind of the market's perspective and how things don't always go the way we think they're going to go?
No, I really liked the whole, when they brought up financial suicide, and I liked how they brought up that guy, that successful trader from the floor, and then a technical analysis thing like that made me, you know, just think about things a little bit. But no, I really liked this chapter. I don't know if you did, but I'm looking forward to Chapter 7. I know you said it's a little bit longer.
It is. No, this was one of my favorite chapters we've done so far, I would say. Although Chapter 1 was fantastic as well. But before we leave, I do want to read this one last sentence, and I've already read it once, but it's just so well stated. Not predefining your risk, not cutting your losses, or not systematically taking profits are three of the most common and usually the most costly trading errors you can make. So to me, out of this whole book, if it's telling me the three most costly and most common trading errors that we're making, I think we need to know it, right? Not predefining your risk, not cutting your losses, and not systematically taking profits. Three of the most common and usually most costly trading errors you can make. So make sure you take that down. But then next week, we're going to get into the next chapter, which is thinking in probabilities. So each one of our, this is where he gets into the system, right? Whenever you're like, oh, because it's above this moving average and the RSI is oversold and the stochastics say this and all that, whatever it is your technical analysis is about, whatever your system is about, you're thinking in probabilities. So I want to get into that in Chapter 7 next week, and it'll be good. So make sure you get here right on time. I will put out the space where you can set the reminder for it. Christine will always retweet it herself or tweet it out herself, and then we will get this party started. And I know you guys want to be there for it, because it is one that I think will be really good for us, which is thinking in probabilities. So that is it. And maybe, this is a real carrot I'll leave out for you, on Christine's encouragement, we'll see if maybe we can get an intro song that is...
I was about to say that. I was going to have a rap song intro.
We'll see. Here's my problem right now. It's snowing here in Texas. And when I say snow, I mean ice. And it's completely miserable. And my kids haven't been in school all freaking week because school is closed. And so because of that, it's just hard to get away. It's hard to lay some tracks down, Christine, to really get that rap song that I know everybody wants. So I'll see if I can get some time alone where I can just lay
you
down.
You ever want to get away?
Is that a lines? What? Anyway, want to get away? Exactly. Yeah. Well, sometimes if I need to spit some bars, Dre, need to have some alone time.
I got
time.
Them on deck, bro. We gonna write the bars. We gonna get them down. We gonna record it. I'm gonna send it to Illa. We gonna be like, yo, we need it on the Hoo Hoo's beat, and then it'll be done.
Okay. I do have a Hoo Hoo's beat because I do exactly. have Hoo Hoo. Which sounds like a funny thing I would record Christine saying. I do indeed have a hoo-hoo. So, all right, everybody, at least for today, this is the music that you got. It's smart music, makes it sound like you really know what you're doing, makes it sound like you've reading that book, put some glasses on, drinking some tea, and you were one smart person. So we will be back on Monday. Make sure you come in there. If you did not see the Golden Hour Book Club poem, you can go into my feed and it'll be there. I'll go ahead and pan it real quick right now, but I'm leaving, so it really doesn't matter. But yeah, there it is. You can look it up right now. All right, guys, we will be back. Christine will be here on Monday along with myself, and we will do this thing all over again. Till then, see you guys at Chapter 7. Love you all. Peace.
I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit.
Jeez. Okay. I mean, damn.
I've had to pee for like 5 minutes, but I won't leave. Buy the blood, don't be a pussy.